if it weren't for courageous people like Mr. Salas and, you know, pain in the asses like myself who feel this needs to be talked about, the public wouldn't know about this.
It, believe me, gives me a little chill just to talk about it.
Oh, yeah.
I'm reliving the whole thing. There's something happening here.
What it is ain't exactly clear. These persons, like Bob Salas, over 120 people that I've interviewed, were trusted by the U.S. government to either operate or guard weapons of mass destruction. I think it's time we stop, children. What's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. And yet, these same people who were entrusted and vetted by the U.S. government, over 100 now, have come forward and said that UFOs not only monitor nuclear weapons, but on occasion tamper with them, either activating them or shutting them down.
This is such a story of tremendous import that all of humanity, the fact that these are extraterrestrials, they're visiting the planet, and how do we deal with them? And that's a subject we should all be involved in, something we should all be talking about.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, Banal of America Audio, with your host, Tim Banal.
What a field day for the heat. What is going on, my friends? This is Tim Banal of banalofamerica.com with another edition of BOA Audio Season 5. We're coming at you much later than expected here this week, and with a couple of different guests than originally expected. We had Marie Jones and Larry Flaxman on deck to appear here on the show this week, but they had to cancel at the last minute, thus throwing BOA Audio into chaos. But we've managed to right the ship and not only have this week's edition of the program here for you, but have a bunch of really cool episodes either already taped or already lined up to be taped for future editions of the show. Don't worry, Marie and Larry will be back on BOA Audio here during Season 5, but in their stead, we have a couple of really fascinating guests here for you on the program. You've heard the first guest previously on the show way back in BOA Audio Season 2. I'm talking about Robert Hastings, esteemed UFO researcher. He has focused in on the UFO connection with nuclear weapons bases and has unearthed just an amazing array of witnesses to that strange connection. And alongside Robert Hastings is notable UFO/nuke witness Bob Salas. Obviously, this is Bob Salas's first appearance on BOA Audio, and I'm very excited to get a chance to have him on the program, not only because I have heard tremendous things about Bob Salas from all different corners of the world of ufology, but also because he had a firsthand experience seeing this UFO-nuke connection in action back when he was serving in the Air Force in 1967. And subsequently had the guts to take his story public in the early 1990s. In this conversation, we're going to get an update from Robert Hastings on his research into the UFO nuke connection. We'll find out about Bob Salas's UFO encounter in March of 1967 at Malmstrom Air Force Base. The duo will reflect on their appearance on Larry King Live from back in 2008. We'll get into some of the tangential aspects of the UFO nuke connection, such as nuclear submarines and nuclear power plants. We'll find out what the pair thinks is really going on with UFOs hovering over nuclear facilities, and they'll detail their impending press conference at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C., scheduled for September 27th. Altogether, it is a fast-paced conversation that covers a hugely important but all too often overlooked area of the UFO phenomenon, with both the researcher who has studiously investigated the story, Robert Hastings, as well as a primary witness to the phenomenon, that being Bob Salas. For those of you who are unfamiliar with Robert Hastings and Bob Salas, I'm going to give you their bios right now. Luckily, they are fairly short. Robert Hastings is a noted UFO researcher and lecturer who has interviewed nearly 100 U.S. Air Force veterans who were involved in nuclear weapons-related UFO incidents. He has interviewed retired military personnel regarding their knowledge of nuclear weapons-related UFO activity and has taken his findings and presented them to colleges and universities nationwide. He's also the author of the book, UFOs and Nukes, His website is www.ufohastings.com. Pretty simple, all one word, ufohastings.com. Next, allow me to provide you with a little background on Bob Salas. Captain Bob Salas graduated from the Air Force Academy and spent 7 years in active duty from 1964 to 1971. He's also held positions at Martin Marietta and Rockwell and spent 21 years at the FAA. In the Air Force, he was an air traffic controller and a missile launch officer, as well as an engineer on the Titan III missiles. Unfortunately, Bob Salas has no website, but he is the co-author of the book Faded Giant with Jim Klotz. Be sure to check that out. And once again, check out Robert Hastings' website, www.ufohastings.com, for more information on UFOs and nukes, as well as their impending press conference at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C. And now, without any further ado, let's rock and roll. This interview was recorded on July 1st, 2010, Robert Hastings and Bob Salas talking about the UFO nuke connection on BOA Audio Season 5. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another edition of Been All of America Audio. Very excited about this week's program, bringing back a former guest here. It's been quite a while since I talked to him, and he's been doing quite a bit since the last time I talked to him. And it was just such a hazy period in my life when we did our original interview that I'm really looking forward to having him back on the program. He is Robert Hastings, the author of UFOs and Nukes. The website ufohastings.com is his site. He is a just masterful researcher of the connection between UFOs and nuclear weapons bases, just a myriad of amazing UFO sightings at nuclear bases that probably most of the people in the mainstream don't know about just yet. But he's working on something big to hopefully alert the public about all this. And alongside him here this week, we've got probably one of the most famous UFO witnesses ever, at least in the contemporary age. He is Bob Salas. He's very well known for his March 1967 UFO sighting at the Malmstrom Air Force Base. He's probably told the story about a million times, and I'm afraid we're going to have him tell the story again, but I'm sure he won't mind. And he's also the co-author of Faded Giant with Jim Klotz. So they're both here on the program to talk about UFOs and nukes, as well as a big project they're working on right now that'll hopefully come to light towards the end of the summer. So welcome back to the show, Robert Hastings, and welcome to the show, Bob Salas.
Thank you much. Thank you, Tim.
It's good to have you back, Robert. It's good to meet you, Bob. I've heard just a whole host of tremendous things about you across the board from all different sorts of people, so it's great to get you on the program here. Robert Hastings, we'll start with you. What have you been up to in the last 3 years since we talked? I know when we first had you on the show back in 07, you were working on the book, and it was nearly done. The book's come out since then. What's been going on for you?
The book was published in July of 08. The same month, Bob Salas and I were on Larry King with two other former Air Force officers, gentlemen like Bob who were involved in nuclear weapons-related incidents. I've simply been plugging along since then. The high-profile publicity I got through Larry King generated a number of leads, dozens of leads, actually, from ex-Air Force personnel, primarily some Navy, some Army, who were involved in incidents of this type where UFOs were near or directly over nuclear weapon sites, either missile silos or weapon storage areas, and on some occasions, like in the case of Mr. Salas, weapons malfunctioned. Missiles went all haywire when these objects were present near them. So the work continues. Programs like yours obviously allow me to present my data to a large audience, and that in turn generates leads. Once I've been approached by somebody, I vet them and check their military service records and other credible information and find out whether or not I consider them to be a reliable source. And fortunately, 99% of the people who approach me are indeed credible. They pan out. They're not hoaxers. They're not liars. And so it's just an ongoing thing for me. It's my life's work, basically.
Nice. Well, I mean, you've done just a tremendous amount of work. The UFO community's indebted to you for what you've done, because I don't know too many other people that have picked up this difficult subject to investigate. Bob Salas, obviously, as I said, you're very famously well-known for this March 1967 UFO incident. So for the folks
who are tuning in who haven't heard you anywhere else before or haven't heard this story before, or maybe you've only heard it, you know, in the distant past. Maybe you should sort of refresh us here and share your story of this UFO sighting at Malmstrom Air Force Base, March 1967.
Okay, sure. In 1967, I was in the Air Force stationed at Malmstrom Air Force Base. I was a first lieutenant. And the day in question, I was on missile duty or alert status at Oscar Flight, which is one of the, I think, 15 flights of 10 missiles that we had at Malmstrom. So each flight is a flight of 10 missiles. I was in a, what's called a launch control center, which is a concrete capsule underground, about 60 feet underground. There's me and my commander. I was a deputy at the time, in the capsule, and we had about, I'd say, 4 to 6 guards, security guards upstairs. When I say upstairs, I mean topside.
Yeah.
And we had kind of a, it looked like a farmhouse where the, we had the cook and the guards had small rooms there. And they had basically, you know, weapons and communication gear upstairs. They had no control over any of the missiles. We had all the computers, all the controls downstairs. At any rate, on this particular night, and I say night, it could have been early in the morning. I'm just not sure of the time.
Yeah.
I do. It was dark. It was dark outside. I get a call from a flight security controller. He's the main guard up there who's watching over things, and he tells me that they're seeing some strange lights up there in the sky, and they're flying at high speeds and making erratic maneuvers, stopping on a dime, changing direction, and absolutely silent. They don't hear any engine noise. They don't understand what the hell these lights are. Well, I listened to this, and I didn't know what to think of it. You know, I didn't pay much attention, really.
Yeah.
And then 5 minutes later, well, I hung up. Then 5 minutes later, he calls back, and this time he's very agitated, screaming into the phone and yelling that he's looking at a glowing red object hovering above the front gate. And this object is oval-shaped. It's he estimated about 30 to 40 feet in diameter. It was glowing red, pulsating. The guards were all out there with their guns, their weapons, and he wanted me to give him some instruction on what to do next. So, not ever having had that experience, I didn't quite know what to tell him. I think I said, make sure nothing comes inside the perimeter fence, obviously, and about that time he had to hang up. One of the guards got injured.
Now, let me stop you for a second, because I've heard this, I've heard your story a few times, and I've always kind of wondered how exactly the guard got injured. Did he, like,
yeah.
What was he doing? Was he climbing the fence? But why? I'm confused about all that.
I surmised he was very frightened.
Okay.
And we had barbed wire at the top of the perimeter fence, and this is a very frightening thing. I've heard this from other witnesses, and of course even the guards later on. Well, let me continue the story.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you a little bit more about that. But so he hangs up the phone. I go over to wake up my commander, Fred Maywald, who is, by the way, still living and has supported my story. I wake him up and tell him about the phone calls, or start to tell him, and all of a sudden we get some bells and whistles going off. And I look at the status panel. We have a panel down there that shows the status of the missiles.
Yep.
And they're starting to go into a unlaunchable mode, a fault mode, no-go, what we called no-go condition.
Mm-hmm.
And I recall we lost all 10 of them.
Jeez.
while this object was still up there, because it was, you know, within a few seconds of that phone call. So we go into our procedures. Fred calls the command post. I call upstairs, because we also got some security lights, in other words, security incursion.
Uh-huh.
At the launch facilities where the missiles are actually located. And I sent guards, a team of guards out to those sites. By this time, the UFO is gone. Fred turns to me then after he reports to the command post and said the same thing happened at another site. And I recall that vividly, trying to recall the memory of this event. That's one thing I do recall so vividly, him turning to me and saying,
yeah,
the same thing happened at another site. That's basically the story. Of course, I can fill in more details about what happened later, but
I think that's the gist of it. I mean, like I said, I think most folks have heard. Now, here's the obvious sort of question. Maybe you've gotten this one before, but do you ever get tired of telling the story? Because I'm sure that you've had to tell the story probably in the thousands of times at this point. Do you ever say, you know, go look it up, asshole, something like that?
Answer is no. I don't get tired of telling the story because it's even today, after, 40-some years, it, believe me, gives me a little chill just to talk about it.
Oh, yeah.
I'm reliving the whole thing. And it was something very dramatic. I'm talking to Fred Maiwald. He's told me that, that's the one thing in his Air Force career. And by the way, Fred Maiwald retired as a full colonel.
Mm-hmm.
He was base commander at Offutt Air Force Base in
oh, yeah.
Nebraska. And Fred remembers this story very well, at least the basic parts of it.
You know, I'm sure they told you to keep quiet about all this after it went down. So what made you decide to come forward and share your story with the world?
Yeah, I was under an oath not to reveal this story. We were told it was secret, classified, not to talk to anybody about it, so I didn't. Then in 1994, I'd got out of the Air Force in, 71. And in 1994, I came across a book, Above Top Secret, by Timothy Good.
Oh, yeah.
And if you turn to page 300 or 301 in that book, you'll see the write-up on the Echo flight shutdown. Echo flight happens to be the other flight that went down. But when I read it, and this was under circumstances of UFOs overhead, when I read it, I thought that was the incident that I was in.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I wrote to the Air Force under, my investigator, Jim Klotz, I asked him to write to the Air Force under the Freedom of Information Act, not mention anything about UFOs, but just ask about documents related to the strange shutdown of 10 missiles in 1967. The Air Force wrote back and said it was a classified incident, but since it had been so long and since we've asked, declassified, and sent us some documents. So they did. They started sending us documents. And as a result of that, I decided, since my incident has been declassified, I'm gonna talk about it. So that's what got me started. It wasn't later until I found out that I'd made a mistake. I wasn't at Echo Flight. I was at Oscar Flight.
So then, yeah, interesting. So now, Robert Hastings, now, are these this sort of story, how typical is this for the types of cases you've collected?
What I'll try to do for your listeners is sort of summarize the whole UFO nuclear weapons connection.
Okay.
There are documents going back at least to December of 1948 that were declassified through the Freedom of Information Act. Documents from the FBI at the Air Force talking about UFOs, saucer-shaped objects. At the time, the documents referred to these objects as flying saucers or flying discs. But anyway, as early as December of 1948, they made repeated incursions over the Los Alamos nuclear weapons lab in my home state of New Mexico. Only some 3.5 years earlier, Los Alamos invented the first atomic bomb, which was tested in the desert of New Mexico. Two more were dropped on Japan, which ended World War II. So basically, you have UFO activity at the birthplace of nuclear weapons, at least within 3 years or so of those momentous events. Many other FBI documents, Air Force documents, even CIA documents confirmed that other nuclear weapons facilities, including Oak Ridge in Tennessee and Hanford in Washington State, Savannah River in South Carolina, places that produced nuclear weapons-related materials, plutonium and uranium, were also the focal point of ongoing UFO activity in the late 40s into the 50s. Now, when nuclear missiles began to be deployed in the early 1960s, not surprisingly, UFO activity began to occur at those sites too. I have interviewed launch officers like Bob Salas, who were at a place called Walker Air Force Base near Roswell, New Mexico, who in 1963 and 64 were having similar incidents where silent, bright objects would hover over the missiles, shine spotlights down on them, terrify the guards. The guards would call down to the launch capsule and talk to the officers and describe all of this. I've interviewed something like half a dozen launch officers, missile maintenance personnel, security personnel. They're describing the same thing at Walker Air Force Base, F.E. Warren Air Force Base in Wyoming. There's a document talking about a UFO hovering over a missile site at Altus Air Force Base in Oklahoma, et cetera, et cetera. So my point is this was very pervasive, very widespread, and intermittent. The most famous cases do come from Malmstrom. They've gotten the most publicity, thankfully, thanks in part, I should say, to Mr. Salas Tender and his bravery in coming forward and talking about this in the face of ridicule, in the face of, you know, what initially he thought were potential repercussions from the government. None of my sources, none of the people who've talked to me, over 120 at this point, have ever been hassled or told threatened in any manner. I think because the government realizes that could backfire on them if these people are courageous enough to come forward with their stories. If the Pentagon leans on them, they're probably going to just go to the media and, you know, say, look, this happened, and now I'm being harassed by the government. So my opinion is that that's why none of the people I've talked to and people like Mr. Salas have ever been threatened. But in any case, this has continued in my book, UFOs and Nukes. I basically have a 60-year history of all of this going on, even into the last two or three years. There has been UFO activity up at the Bangor nuclear missile submarine base in Washington State, repeated sightings of UFOs hovering or flying over the weapons storage area up there where the Trident nuclear missile warheads are stored, flying over the Hood Canal where the missiles or where the submarines are moored and so on. And the most recent development actually comes from, I'm not going to mention his name, but he's a former security policeman, Air Force policeman who worked at Area 2, which was Nellis Air Force Base, Nevada's nuclear weapons storage area, who has described for me and Mr. Salas, he's talked to him as well, this individual has talked about repeated UFO activity at the nuclear weapons storage site up there in Nevada within the last 2 years. So this has been going on since the 40s. It's continuing to the present. And not even 2 weeks ago, a Russian newspaper called Life, a huge circulation newspaper, 2 million readers, published a story about an incident in the former Soviet Union where back in 1982, a UFO hovered over an unspecified number of nuclear missiles, and they temporarily activated and were preparing to launch until after 15 seconds, the anomaly ceased. That kind of thing is being described in both of the former, nuclear power adversaries during the Cold War, the U.S. and the USSR. I'm sure it's gone on to the same degree over there as it has here. It's just harder to get the information from Russia.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, I had Paul Stonehill on recently, and we were talking about USOs, and I know there's a lot of, like, nuclear submarines and stuff like that. Have you gotten any sort of information regarding, you know, any sort of, I don't know if they'd necessarily be underwater, but, you know, USOs or UFOs related to the nuclear submarine aspect of it all?
Beginning about 10 years ago, I attempted to focus on former and retired naval personnel who were involved with nuclear weapons in the Navy. And I just found that I had the door slammed in my face, basically. These people are very tight-lipped. I have used the card, the fact that I'm an Air Force brat. My dad was career Air Force. And when I approach former or retired Air Force personnel, I sort of say that up front to try to establish some sort of camaraderie. Whether that has helped me or not, they have been far more forthcoming than the Navy people. I am aware of these reports of the incidents at Bangor and another Navy nuclear missile base on the East Coast called Kings Bay in Georgia, where there are ongoing UFO reports at those two home ports for these submarine fleets. But I cannot honestly say that I've interviewed anybody who I consider credible who could attest to being involved out at sea in a nuclear missile submarine carrying submarine who could report a UFO incident to me.
Okay, yeah, it seems like the Navy's more tight-lipped about all this stuff than the Air Force.
In my experience.
Yeah, that's what I've heard too, so that's not too surprising. Let's dive into this big project you guys are working on, because it seems like, you know, that's on the tip of your tongues right now, and this is a press conference you guys are planning to put together for September 27th, I believe, at the National Press Club, but you can correct me if I'm wrong. I guess talk a little bit about what your plans are for this press conference, how it came together, and what your goals are with all this.
Well, yeah, Robert and I both decided that it's high time we got a group of credible witnesses together that have had direct involvement with UFOs at nuclear weapons sites, mm-hmm. Like my own. And as Robert said, there are quite a few credible witnesses. We're going through that process right now. We're asking these fellows, and at this point, I don't think we want to name too many names, although one name I think, Robert, maybe you can mention later on. But we think this is important enough to gather these people together and go to Washington, D.C., go to the National Press Club, and on September 27th, we've already got a room reserved. And we're going to be there, and for a couple of hours, we're going to, you know, invite the press and hand out press kits of the cases of the witnesses, and in addition, we'll have press kits of other cases where the witnesses either declined, but were willing to at least put down their stories in affidavits. And we're going to open the book on these things, so we're hoping the press will get deeply involved in it. And looking into these cases, making them as public as possible, and just get the word out. That's our main objective is to inform the public.
Yeah, yeah. Now, there's been a lot of UFO press conferences at the National Press Club, it seems, in the last 5 years. So, I mean, I applaud your effort, but I'm also skeptical in the sense that I feel like that they've become cynical to it, I guess the press there or something. Do you know what I mean? But I guess, what do you think of that whole thing? Because, I mean, you got to recognize that there's been at least six press conferences at the National Press Club since 2004 regarding UFOs.
Absolutely. There's no doubt the press is skeptical. The public is skeptical. But, you know, in my opinion, the more credible witnesses, the good cases, by good I mean multiple witnesses, documented cases, you know, cases that can be backed up in some way, the more of those that are out there in the public and that the public hears, eventually, I think, and it's just my personal opinion, but eventually I think there'll be such a large number of these cases that the mainstream media won't be able to ignore them.
Yeah, sort of like I had Rich Dolan on the show. He sort of drew the analogy to you need a lot of shots on goal if you're going to score in hockey. So you just take as many shots on goal as you can, I guess, right?
My take on it is this. Basically, these persons, like Bob Salas, all the over 120 people that I've interviewed, were trusted by the U.S. government to either operate or guard weapons of mass destruction. They were vetted. They were not flakes. They did not have psychological problems. These were stable, reliable people who, in the horrible case, if war had come to pass with the Soviet Union, would have been responsible for launching weapons that would have killed millions of people, and the Soviet launch officers would have killed Americans in the millions. So that's the dire situation that existed had, you know, keys actually been turned and missiles launched. And yet, these same people who were entrusted and vetted by the U.S. government, over 100 now, have come forward and said that UFOs not only monitor nuclear weapons, but on occasion tamper with them, either activating them or shutting them down. And that apparently has gone on in the former Soviet Union. So, you know, since World War II, for decade after decade after decade until the early 90s, the whole world basically was on the edge of its seat, not knowing whether nuclear Armageddon would take place, but knowing full well that if it did, human civilization and maybe even the stability of the environment of the planet would be gone, would be history. And so, you know, humankind has never faced this kind of crisis in its history where weapons finally existed that would allow literally human civilization to be wiped off the map in a matter of minutes. And if, you know, that situation were not dramatic enough, what has clearly emerged is that outside observers flying vastly superior technological craft have been quite clearly monitoring on a covert basis, on an ongoing basis, these weapon sites and have been interfering with their functionality on both sides of the ocean. Mr. Salas and I and most of my sources, three quarters of the people I've interviewed, roughly, are of the opinion that the technology is so superior to anything on Earth. These clearly are visitors from somewhere else. They've probably been monitoring this planet for a long, long time and have realized just since the end of World War II that we've reached a crossroads where if things go horribly wrong, we could greatly change the course of human destiny. So, you know, this obviously is a huge and major story. The media has been ignoring it in part because there is an overall skepticism about UFOs on the part of large numbers of people, including reporters. I think another factor is a journalist named Terry Hansen, if you have not had him on, would be a wonderful guest. He has written an authoritative book about how the intelligence community has infiltrated the American media for decades, basically steering national security-related stories of one kind or another in one direction or another, or even suppressing them with the media's complicity. And UFOs definitely falls in that category. So despite the resistance of the skeptical media, the skeptical public, behind-the-scenes shenanigans on the part of the CIA, NSA and other groups, Mr. Salas and I and others believe that this is a story that needs to be told. I sort of view it as water dripping on a stone. Eventually you wear away the stone, and that's what we're trying to do.
Can I add a couple of things to what Robert said?
Sure, go ahead.
Just to tie in, this is not just about UFOs. It's about nuclear weapons and the abolishment of nuclear weapons. As you know, an agreement with the Russians on reducing the stockpile of nuclear weapons ratified by the Senate, and that's going to be a difficult process. But that's the other aspect of this. We want to push for the abolishment of nuclear weapons as part of this. And the other aspect Robert also touched on was secrecy, very deep secrecy involving UFOs in a lot of government agencies, and there's probably some kind of a small civilian group involved too. And this is such a story of tremendous import that all of us, all of humanity, the fact that if these are extraterrestrials, they're visiting the planet, and how do we deal with them? And that's a subject we should all be involved in, something we should all be talking about.
Absolutely, yeah, that's for sure. So now, based on what you've said, Robert, it sounds like you dismiss the idea of the theory that some have put forward that maybe these UFO over nuke base sightings were some kind of training exercise. I've heard that put out by, you know, various schools of thought. I guess you take it that that's probably not the case based on the advanced technology that you've seen or heard of being seen.
it's a completely implausible scenario. The people that advance that, some of them have an interesting agenda. I will just say probably most of them are skeptical. They don't believe in UFOs in the first place, so they have to come up with a way of explaining away what has taken place.
Yeah.
But if you talk to the eyewitnesses and the ear witnesses, I remember the people down the capsule, like Mr. Salas, as ear witnesses. They heard over the radio, they're scared, they're frightened guards. The guards would have been eyewitnesses to all of this. You know, I've got over 120 eyewitnesses and ear witnesses who were directly involved in the action, and they say that there is no way that what these objects did, the way they performed, there's no aircraft on Earth that could achieve those maneuvers. I have interviewed at least, I would say, 7 or 8 air traffic controllers who were at Malmstrom Air Force Base in the 60s and 70s during the period when all of this was going on involving Mr. Salas and the other officers. And in my book, I've got a whole chapter in which the taped, you know, verbatim testimony of the air traffic controllers were talking about tracking UFOs on an ongoing basis, objects that would cover 200 miles in just a couple of seconds, zigzagging the whole way. I mean, again, there is no aircraft on Earth, Russian or American, that can do that. So it's quite clear that we're not dealing with a technology that's based anywhere in Russia or the U.S. or Samoa. I alluded a moment ago to a subcategory of skeptics, quote unquote, who, if you dig into their backgrounds, have a very interesting connection with the government that they seem to be shy about talking about. There was a group for many years called PSYCOP. It's now called CSI, the Committee for Skeptical Inquiry. The most famous UFO debunker affiliated with them was Philip Klass, who's deceased now, Jim Oberg, people like that. In any case, they published this. That organization publishes this magazine, Skeptical Inquirer, and I discovered several years ago that the editor of this magazine, Kendrick Fraser, who is listed merely as a science writer in the magazine, had a very interesting day job for 20-something years while he was bunking UFOs. He was also a public relations specialist for Sandia National Laboratories, one of this nation's largest leading nuclear weapons laboratories. And I was the person who really talked about that publicly to the point where a lot of people became aware of it finally. So they present themselves as scientifically oriented skeptics, but if you look into their backgrounds, they have some very interesting connections with both the military and the intelligence community. Jim Oberg, again, a skeptic, quote-unquote, who thinks UFOs are nonsense, did classified work involving nuclear weapons at Kirtland Air Force Base in the early 70s. One of the jobs he had was security officer within his group at the Phillips lab that was engaged in nuclear weapons research. And so, in other words, one of his jobs in the Air Force was protecting nuclear weapons secrets. And coincidentally or not, he has been one of the chief critics of people coming forward that I've talked to who are talking about UFOs at nuclear weapon sites. He's been one of the people to poo-poo it in the most strident fashion. So I simply say, dig below the surface. The leading skeptics who are saying this is all nonsense and that my sources don't know what they're talking about, look at who they work for or have affiliations with and draw your conclusions.
Yeah, well, I just want to get that out there because I figured you'd have a response to that skeptical take on it. I obviously, you know, if it was some kind of testing procedure, then, you know, why wouldn't you just stick the nukes on the things that were flying over the nuclear base? It sounds like they're more powerful than jets anyway, so it doesn't seem to make any sense to me.
In my particular case, you know, this occurred in March of 67. I was on duty there until June of 69. So in that time period, over 2 years, we never got debriefed on the shutdowns at Oscar or Echo Flight. And that's very unusual because we had briefings every time we went on alert. We had briefings about the equipment, any modifications that were going to be going on, activities in the field, et cetera. We were supposedly completely briefed. And after I was doing my investigation on my incident, I find that there was indeed an extensive investigation going on about why it was these missiles went down. So if it had been an Air Force exercise, as as you might imagine, the Air Force would have debriefed us on how we performed in this exercise.
Exactly, so
this,
yeah.
This was definitely no Air Force exercise.
Now, that raises an interesting sort of question here that has been rolling around my head here for the last couple of minutes. It might be interesting to sort of figure out, at least to put yourself in the shoes of the government, at least as far as how their reactions to these events have been or maybe have changed over the years. We'll start with you, Bob. You know, what were the higher-ups? What was their reaction to this whole thing? You said that there was an investigation into it. Was this like something that they acted like, you know, this is par for the course that these UFOs show up over our bases, or was it like this is something they've never heard of before and they were freaking out over it, you know, not just the dudes, you know, that you worked with on the base, but, you know, the people above you and stuff like that?
Yeah, well, if we're talking about the Air Force as a whole, I want to make this connection with the Condon Committee, and I've written an article about this. It's on UFO Chronicles if you want to read it, but the Condon Committee was organized in the summer of '66, and by 1967 they had, they were investigating cases. And one of the investigators, Dr. Roy Craig, was told by Ray Fowler that UFOs had been reported at Malmstrom Air Force Base during the shutdown of Echo Flight. I don't know if he mentioned Oscar, but I know he mentioned Echo. And you got to look into it. So Roy Craig dutifully, as part of the Condon Committee, came to Malmstrom Air Force Base in October of 1967 and was told by Colonel Lewis Chase, who happened to be, quote-unquote, the base UFO officer. By that time, the Air Force had designated certain officers at certain bases to help them with their so-called investigation, and they designated UFO officers. So Colonel Chase was one of these and told Craig that, no, there was nothing to those reports of UFOs over missile sites and the Echo shutdown. So essentially he lied to Craig. He knew full well because of all, you know, the reports that had been made, and the ongoing investigation that the Air Force internally was making. Craig basically turned around and went home. He didn't investigate further. He didn't interview witnesses, and he had some names to interview given to him by Fowler. And he just turned around and went home. And they just, they just whitewashed the whole thing. Yeah. And I've got documentation on that. I mean, I've got a lot of document and supporting evidence about that. And again, you can read about that on UFO Chronicles. As far as my immediate squadron commander, when we were returned to base after my incident, I walked into my squadron commander's office. I was ordered to go there. There was a member of Air Force Office of Special Investigation there with him. Now, Colonel Eldridge, who was my squadron commander, was an ex-B-17 World War II pilot, fought in World War II, and he was well-decorated, highly decorated. I had a lot of respect for him. He was white as a sheet. He had no idea what had happened or why. So, certainly, you know, he was not aware of why this happened.
Just this ties in with what Bob is talking about, and I think it would be appropriate to mention it. I'm not sure which of the press conference participants you had in mind when you said I could mention someone, but I'm going to go ahead and mention Bob Jamieson, who appeared on Larry King with Bob Salas and myself and another individual. In any case, Bob Jamieson was at Malmstrom when Bob Salas was there. Unlike Bob, who was a launch officer, Bob Jamieson was a targeting officer who basically would program the guidance system so the warheads would hit their targets in the Soviet Union had they been launched. In any case, roughly 3 years before Bob Salas even went public, I had never heard of Bob Salas until he appeared on Sightings program with Jim Klotz in the mid-90s, I believe 1995. In any case, 3 years prior to that, at one of my lectures in Merced, California, in the audience, Bob Jamieson attended and came up to me and said, I was a targeting officer at Malmstrom. I heard you allude to a shutdown mentioned by Raymond Fowler at the base. I was involved in bringing up that that the group of missiles. Over the course of time, I interviewed Mr. Jameson. He was invited to appear on Larry King with Bob Salas and myself. In any case, 3 years before even Bob Salas went public, Jameson was telling me that he was called down to the missile maintenance hangar. An entire flight of missiles had gone down. When he arrived at the hangar, everybody was buzzing about UFOs being sighted around the shutdowns. He eventually was officially briefed to that effect. The missile maintenance commander said none of the targeting teams, maintenance teams, will be allowed into the field until UFO activity, UFO reports have ceased. In the meantime, Jameson went to a temporary command post that had been set up in this hangar and overheard a radio exchange over a couple of hours between Air Force personnel on site at a place, a canyon near the base, Belt Canyon, a little town of Belt, where a UFO had landed on the same night when further east, over 100 miles further east, all of Bob's missiles were shut down. In any case, because that Belt Canyon incident was publicized the next day in the Great Falls Tribune, we can pinpoint the date of the Oscar flight shutdown, and it was March 24th, the evening of the 24th in 1967. And I believe, if I'm not mistaken, Bob, that in some of the documentation that you got from Roy Craig's papers and files, that date was provided to him, March 24th, as a shutdown incident date. So Bob Jameson told me, you know, explicitly that they were told by their briefers, their commanders, that UFOs had been involved in the shutdowns. They were told that if they were on the way out to the missiles to repair them, if they saw a UFO on the road, they were to report it immediately. If when they were at the site and were bringing the missiles back up, they were to, all of them, with the exception of the guard, get down in underground through what's called the personnel access hatch into the missile silo and leave the guard outside, who would report by radio what the UFO was doing. So they were given explicit orders and instructions as to how to respond, all involving UFO involvement in the incidents. So, you know, and all of this was told to me, you know, before Mr. Salas came forward. So there are, you know, persons who have attacked Mr. Salas and say that there's no evidence for what he says, no corroborating witnesses. That's simply untrue. They either have an agenda to try to destroy Mr. Salas' reputation, or they simply are unaware of the facts. But there are credible persons, former military officers, who were involved in these incidents, and they all point to a UFO involvement with the shutdowns.
Now, Bob, Roberts sort of alluded to this. What's it been like for you as a witness to sort of had to deal with the slings and arrows of the skeptics and even the, you know, the ufologists who are just very, you know, they'll put you through the ringer just to make sure you're telling the truth. I mean, what's it been like for you as a witness to have to go through that kind of experience?
Well, I kind of chuckle at some of the skeptics. You know, we were on the Larry King show together, and we had Bill Nye, the science guy, on there, right?
Oh, boy.
And Larry King, I love the guy, but he likes to have little surprises now and then. And somehow Bill Nye, the science guy, got hold of some document having to do with, I think it was the air chiller unit that had a problem. He got a hold of a report and pointed to the air chiller unit as the cause for the missile shutdowns. Well, that's just way off base. The air chiller unit has nothing to do with missiles going offline. Matter of fact, we have a very sophisticated system of checking the cause of why they went down, and it was guidance and control system failure. Somehow the UFOs were able to interfere with the guidance systems of each of these missiles individually, and it's just an amazing thing. It's just a phenomenal thing that they were able to do. So the problem is with the skeptics is they don't do their homework. They simply don't understand the depth of the incident. And In my case, we've got a lot of documentation. All I had to do was read my book
and look at the documents that I've got in the appendix in that book, and they would have a better understanding. But so most of the skeptics, most of the criticism I get are from people that just have not done their homework.
Was there any sort of interaction, you know, after the show with the Bill Nye guy? Because, I mean, if I were you, I'd be pretty pissed off. I'd be like, dude, you don't know what you're talking about.
Well, no, I more or less ignored the guy. I mean, my understanding, and I don't mean to make an issue out of Bill Nye because I don't know him that well. I just met him before the show. But my understanding is he doesn't even have an advanced scientific degree. And yet he comes on a lot of shows as a kind of a science expert. But I don't think he really is. So, I just kind of ignored him.
What about you, Robert? Did you say anything? You seem like the type who would find him over by the vending machine after the show ended and, you know, give him a couple shots to the ribs or something. What happened here?
Bob Salas, Bob Jamison, Bob Jacobs, the third Air Force officer, and myself, all of us Bobs or Roberts, were on the first 30 minutes.
Right.
They brought Bill Nye on the last 10 minutes of the first half-hour segment, at which point we were all removed, with the exception of Bill Nye. I had to immediately catch a flight, so I was whisked back to LAX to catch a flight. I didn't get to talk to anyone. But I know that I don't think Bob was on the second 30 minutes, if I'm not mistaken. I think there was Stan Friedman and some other people on with Bill Nye. So I didn't have a chance to interact. There's really no point. I've spoken at over 500 colleges and universities since 1981. Invariably, I will get self-appointed UFO experts who, with all due respect to their expertise in their own fields, astronomy, physics, psychology, know absolutely nothing about my field and try to come across as experts. And I've just learned, other than asking them, you know, in front of the audience whether they've ever studied the documents or interviewed any witnesses that demonstrate to everyone present how ignorant they are, that's really all you can do, because their mind's made up. There's no point arguing with them. There's a fair amount of arrogance in academia. This does not really apply to Bill Nye because of his lack of advanced degrees, but in any case, there are people who spent their entire lives in academia who, you know, their whole well-being, their whole sense of self-worth is predicated on being the intellectual in the room who has the answers for everything. And when they come across someone like me, you know, who graduated from college, almost got a master's degree, but certainly it doesn't have a doctorate, that they view me as a germ, you know, something that is just to be, you know, kind of scraped off their shoes. So that's the reality of the situation.
All right. Well, I just, you know, I figured I'd ask. You never know. Sometimes you catch a little nugget or something when you're off the air with some of these guys, you know.
I'm Bob Slidell. This is my associate, Bob Porter.
Oh, hi, Bob. Bob?
You're listening to Banal of America Audio.
This is heavy duty, Doc. This is great. Does it run like on regular unleaded gasoline?
Unfortunately, no. It requires something with a little more kick. Plutonium.
Plutonium. Wait a minute. Are you telling me that this sucker is nuclear?